welcome to the Back Page Video Games Podcast. I'm Samuel Roberts, joined as ever by Matthew Castle.
Hello.
Matthew, we're joined by another special guest. Alex, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Alex Wiltshire. I don't expect anyone to know me, but I used to work on Edge. I used to edit Edge for a time. I work these days at Mojang. I sort of do kind of writing-y things around games, I suppose. But my heart is still at Future, just like yours is still encased in ice and concrete there as well.
Yeah, for sure. I'm sure a lot of our listeners know who you are because you're a regular on Crate and Crowbar as well, right? So the podcast that people might know you from. Yeah, like don't talk yourself down, Alex, is what I'm saying, basically. But
but if I talk myself down, I can't get any worse, you know?
Yeah, that's fair enough.
It's only up from there.
How are you doing anyway? Are you well?
I'm good. Yeah, no, like life is good and it's sunny today. I'm fine.
You've just walked your incredibly smelly dog.
Yeah. Of course you've experienced our dog, yeah. I should say that Matt and I have a semi-regular board gaming session that we play in with some other friends, and I invited up my dog to one of our sessions, and he spent the entire time farting under the table, and and Matt won't forget it.
No, it was, we played a 6 or 7 hour game of Dune, the board game based on Dune, and we had a sort of a Hans Zimmer soundtrack playing in the background for atmosphere. But then every like half an hour or so, just this rancid sulfur would kind of rise up from under the table, which maybe captures some of the majesty of fucking Arrakis or whatever.
Yeah, it's like a spice worm kind of blooming or something. I was thinking also, like, would it have helped if he'd made a sound like a Hans Zimmer style kind of trumpeting sound every time he did it as
deep
well?
Booming.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. Just what I want is the angry bagpipes combined with dog farts. That's a classic tune. Exactly what Frank Herbert wanted, I think. So yes, yeah. Alex, thank you so much for coming on. We're trying to collect all the Edge editors, I guess. That's sort of become a sort of side project to this podcast.
Yeah, it was really good to hear Margaret on it the other day. Yeah, well, not the day, yeah. Other month.
yeah. Margaret, who I met in Japan, actually, that was a fun evening. She had to endure me being incredibly ill, but yeah, that was illuminating hearing her talk about Yakuza and making games in Fortnite. That was cool. But yeah, we're sort of like gathering them. I don't know why we started doing this, really, but obviously, you know, a lot of cool people have edited Edge over the years, and we know you, so definitely been on our target list. So thank you for understanding enough to come on. We do appreciate it. That's cool.
It's an honor to be your next butterfly to be pinned in the cage.
It's I think you're all individual pieces of a summoning circle for Tony.
Yeah, maybe there's a bit of that to it. But yeah, so also you just have a really interesting career, both, you know, in games media and out of games media, so lots to get into. I'm happy to have you on here to probe you. Why did I say probe? That's bad choice of words, really. So in the first half we're going to talk a bit about your time on Edge, and then in the second half we'll talk a bit more about some of the things you've been doing recently, which by recently I mean the last 11 years, so quite a long period of your life, but excited to get into it. So Alex, to kick off with, what's your background in games? How did you get into them?
I wanted to for a long time and then didn't for a long time. So I grew up with not loving games, but not really having enough time, an opportunity to actually play them. We didn't have a game playing computer or thing in our house for ages. And then we got a BBC B that my uncle gave us, which was at the time very old. Like, it was already very old. I didn't get a console, didn't get a SNES until like the SNES died. I think that was sort of been like 1994 or 5 or something. So everything I did was a little bit late until I got a PC in the sort of like mid late 90s. And then I kind of, you know, I knew that there was something about them I really wanted to do. Went to university, studied geography, which is a subject you do when you don't know what you want at all from life. Because what do you do? Like, people would ask sort of like, oh, you want to be a geography teacher? It's the kind of subject where the only thing that you seems to logically stem from studying it is to teach other people a subject that has no logical purpose. But geography is super interesting, actually, because basically it allows you to study anything as long as you can pin it to any kind of sort of anything relating to a place. And so I just sort of freewheeled and just sort of did a dissertation on Britpop and Blur, because you could talk about place about it, and like, you know, the sort of social constructions of nations and kind of identity and stuff. I mean, it sounds like it was quite wanky.
That sounds fun.
Yeah, it was fun, and I did lots of, you know, sort of political geography and social geography, all that stuff. I didn't really do any of the sort of mountains and streams and rivers and stuff, because
you weren't big on your longshore drift.
Was not big on that, mostly because it meant leaving the house and my room and things, because, you know, I know that I'm in a community of people who prefer not to, so I can be proud about that. I came out not really knowing what I wanted to do, and then remembered one thing that I wanted to do, which was like, I wanted to write. I wanted to be a journalist, sort of way back from when I was at school. And I basically just wanted to write about games, really, but I didn't really know an awful lot about what that would entail. But I did know what, you know, writing meant, publishers and books and things like that. So I took a punt on just writing to a few publishers and ended up working at a book publisher called Conran Octopus that did, it was owned or was established by Terence Conran, the designer, and it was just interior design and gardening and cooking books, not anything I was particularly interested in. I was interested in architecture, which it did a few, sort of fairly light architectural stuff, and that was sort of what sort of interested me. But I started off as a receptionist for them, sort of working on the phone at the front desk in Covent Garden, and then ended up in the production department, which is the people that organise the printing of the books. And I did production for a few years and slowly went mad, because organising the printing of books wasn't really exactly what I wanted to do in publishing. And then did a journalism course, ended up at an architecture magazine called Icon. It was fascinating, but not a world that I particularly... I kept trying to put games into the magazine because I felt very strongly that games, video games are all about design, and that video game designers think very much like chair designers, but probably a lot more interestingly about design than chair designers. But my editors didn't really feel the same way as me.
Do you have a favorite video game building?
it's got to be Half-Life one, I think, because, well, there's the control, like, so the control, there's one because of its love of concrete, and I do love a nice concrete building. But it's, I think of all games, Half-Life understands what buildings really are, which is that they are these kind of layers of different uses that change and adapt them over time. So you, in any Half-Life level, you look at it and you can see a history of a place, and you can see sort of what the building might have been when it first built, and then how, what happened after that, and it was converted into apartments or something, and then the Combine turned up and started fucking things up, and, you know, and then sort of people were very unhappy. It's like layers and layers and stuff. So it's Half-Life buildings. Maybe the train station Half-Life 2. Let's do that one.
Oh,
yeah, it's a good shout. So how do they become a larger part of your life in the midst of that?
Yeah, there was something about them. There was something about the freedoms that they gave that just fascinated me really early on. So I remember my uncle who gave us that BBC. He visited. He came to visit us when I was really young, maybe sort of 7 or 8 years old. And he brought that same machine, but when it was still his. And he had a copy of, like, and he showed us this. Flight sim, a wireframe sort of 3D flight sim. I think it was Spitfire based, and I flew under a bridge, and it was just sort of insane. It literally ran at, like, you know, 4 frames a second or something, but it was just insanely exciting to me that you'd have this sort of 3D space you explore. And then he had The Hobbit, which, you know, that text parser kind of Magic, where you feel you can type anything into the game and it will respond in some way. And The Hobbit was particularly good, you know, as one of those text parser games that, which sort of did seem to respond kind of very as if there was a world written in text beyond
kill
the
Gandalf
parser. kill Thorin.
Gandalf.
Yeah. I didn't get very far, obviously, but like those games, they just like lit something in me, and you know, it was just forever kind of I want more of that, I want that, I want that. So that was what sort of interested me. And then, but then I just didn't have any money, and my parents were not interested in computers, and you know, not you know, sort of didn't really see anything particularly exciting in games or in it's interactive, anything like that. So there was never opportunity until, you know, I had my own cash to buy a secondhand Nintendo and a Super Nintendo, and then a secondhand PC later on. And then that was that, really.
Yeah, yeah. So I suppose from there, what become your key texts in games? What are the foundations of your taste in games, The Hobbit and an old Spitfire game aside?
So I think, yeah, it's that freedom thing. I think one of the games I was sort of probably foundationally interested in was UFO Enemy Unknown, or XCOM XCOM Enemy Unknown. That's what the American name was, wasn't it? Was it something like that?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
yeah. This was the one that came out in 1994 or so, and I played it sort of when I was at university. And it was just sort of this completely mechanics-led open game where, you know, you could put your base anywhere in the world and you could go on whichever missions that you wanted to. And those missions would be different every time, and you could approach them in any way you wanted. You could, and the squad of soldiers that you had were the ones that you had nurtured, that you were choosing, that you had equipped with the stuff that you had got, and the mission that you were sending them on was somewhat, you know, quite strongly self-led, where, you know, this one I want to capture like one of the enemy sectoids, and that was the thing that you'd set yourself to do in that mission. That was the game that kind of I think I've been seeking ever since, you know, and like often found them, you know, they're kind of common now actually, but that was the one that sort of really set kind of that's what I like in games, that sort of sense of guided freedom, and you know, in a very specific place and world with a very specific sort of thing that you're trying to do, but within that specificity, you know, you can do what you like. And that's, yeah, that was the excitement.
Cool. Yeah, I can see why.
Oh, and also, I mean, well, having said that, like opposite end of the thing, the Super Mario World, which I played around the same time, like this sense of just sort of colorful invention, but also, you know, unlocking things, you know, you've done this, you know, you've succeeded at this level and now you can do these things, and you know, sort of steadily this kind of game opening up as you, you know, you succeed as its challenges. That was, I found that, yeah, beautiful as well.
Do you rate the architecture of the ghost houses?
No, they're bullshit.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah, so I guess early 90s was kind of the big sort of reawakening moment for you with games then, I guess, or at least, you know, I suppose like the first wave of you figuring out what your taste in games is. So yeah. I guess around sort of like Doom time as well, probably a big deal when you were getting into games.
Yeah, for sure.
That time frame.
The sort of Doom sort of disc sort of went around school, and everybody sort of took turns at kind of, you know, taking the Doom disc and installing it from it. And yeah, that was great.
Awesome. So were games magazines a big part of your life as a younger man? When do they enter the equation?
Yeah, so I know that everybody but me, it seems, kind of grew up on the kind of the classic sort of 80s, 90s kind of game magazines, you know, sort of the ones. You know the ones?
Amiga Power, etc.
Amiga Power, which I didn't have an
Super
Amiga.
Superplay, CDG,
which I didn't. I didn't read any of them. I read... once I got a PC, I read PC Gamer sporadically because ultimately I didn't really have any money. So I didn't, the idea of buying something that told me, like, look at this cool thing and you can't have it because I didn't have any. I didn't read that many of them. And it was always sort of object led. So it was only later on when I started reading journalism and writing as because I was interested in that as a career and you know, and a vocation, and also once I had more machines, you know, sort of suddenly, you know, Edge was the one. I came into contact with Edge because initially, actually, sort of, you know, sort of fairly deep into its history, really, because a friend of mine worked at a studio called Elixir, which Edge had put on its cover at some point, and they'd asked the so Demis Hassabis, who is now the head of DeepMind at Google, he'd established the company and had a column in Edge, writing about games and about what it meant to start a studio and kind of, you know, have big ideas and things. And so, yeah, one of my friends worked with him at there. And so I just came into contact with Edge because my friend was in it. And then, of course, the rest of the magazine was talking about games, like, in the way that I was thinking about them and wanted to think about them. I think it was more like it. You definitely wrote about games in the way that I wanted to think about games. And then that was, like, I subscribed from then, really.
So what kind of time frame is this? Is this...
1998, 1999, right. That would have been, yeah,
the key moments in Edge's history, essentially. Yeah. Okay, so I do a lot of LinkedIn stalking to make these episodes. always fun to do that and see how people write about their careers. So you sort of like pivot at some point into working on a property-based website for Channel 4, is that right? Oh. So how do you go from that to being deputy editor of Edge? Because I think that's quite an impressive transition that you go in at deputy editor level. So how did that happen, essentially?
it's a fairly tedious story, really. Like, so I worked on this design magazine called Icon, and I kind of reached this point where the next roll up would probably be in deputy editor, but the deputy editor there was not only very good but had no reason to leave, and by that time we had my wife and I had a son, and I needed more money. We were living in London and things were tight, and so I asked the company, like, sort of, what can I do, and they had recently got this company was called Media 10. And they, we were based in Epping, so up in Essex, sort of the very, very, very end of the Central Line. And I lived in Camden, and I was commuting the wrong way from everybody else. Which meant I got a seat. I played a lot of Game Boy Advance games back then, it was on this hour journey each way. But it was a sort of weird little enclave of kind of quite she sort of design magazines. And so anyway, they just got a contract to make a magazine for Channel 4 that was based on all Channel 4's kind of, you know, sort of interiors and design shows, like sort of Place in the Sun.
Location, at that point.
Yeah, all of that. So all of those shows, Kirstie and Phil and all that stuff. Those Cleaners. Do you remember the Cleaners? Those are awful.
Oh, yeah,
awful.
Kim and Aggie.
That. So this magazine was going to be was based on all of those shows, and they wanted the magazine was going to be made by the company I work for, and Channel 4 had this quite highfalutin idea that the Channel 4 website would would be the online home of the magazine, and so they needed someone that would work across Channel 4 and the publisher, and they offered that to me, and it was. It was a job. What it really entailed was watching these shows and doing praises and synopses of them and putting them on and taking screenshots of them.
Kirstie and Phil look at another house. Yeah. It's got five rooms, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was grim. I stuck it out for a while and then moved on. But it was. Yeah, it was super interesting. It was really interesting to know what Channel 4, what TV's really like and it's a real sausage factory, even more so than magagines.
Well, I promised that my mum at the time would have read whatever you were putting together. That's like her version of the MCU, basically, as all of those shows and grand designs. So, yeah.
I like the idea of an editor losing their mind because they haven't got new Kim and Aggie character art for the cover.
It literally was like that. Like, the magazine staff were constantly saying, we need something from Channel 4 to put in the magazine, but they won't send us anything. And I was like, because I was this sort of meant to be in the middle, I was meant to know the answers, and I didn't. It was terrible.
Move over, bungalows. It's barn conversions.
I got complained at by one of the stars as well. I got a phone call from one of them, an awful, awful human being, who I can't name, and they were having going at me because of something was in the magazine. It was like, I don't know. Yeah, not a world I wanted to move back to.
Yeah, okay. So how does that lead to Edge from there then? That's actually, I'm really glad you told that story. That's much more interesting than you gave it credit for, Alex.
Well, so at this point, I really, really wanted to work for Edge. And I managed to get a piece of freelancing in with them. I'd pitched some stuff to Margaret, just sent an email and Margaret said, well, I don't, you know, those ideas, they're all very nice, but they're kind of done, you know, in that classic way. We've all experienced the sort of the early freelancer sort of pitches where they're all fine ideas, but done a million times. But she said, but would you like to do this? And what this was straight in with this feature about that Arcane, cancelled Arcane game called The Crossing. Do you know about that one?
Oh, yeah.
So it was this very, very high concept game that actually, like lots of ideas, sort of you can see in their games ever since, especially in stuff like, what's the more recent one set on the crazy island? Where
Deathloop.
Really, there's loads of Deathloop in it. So you'd have these sort of, it's a multiplayer game, but sort of like you'd have players that were sort of playing for the Inquisition were on one side and then the other players on the other side. And you'd be playing this single player game and then other players would come into it and you'd fight with them. It was very high concept. And it was set in this kind of modern or futuristic world as if, but this world was like, as if the Templars had somehow not dissolved and somehow kind of gained control of it. So it was all these sort of skyscrapers and things made that looked like castles, sort of going up into the sky and that sort of thing. And it was art directed by Viktor Antonov, who was the art director for Half-Life 2. And I'd written this thing about Half-Life 2 for the design magazine I used to work on, Icon. And Margaret had seen that and said, right, okay, well, why don't you write? And I'd interviewed Victor for that. And so I got to do this thing from The Crossing. Big old feature. And, you know, and sort of it went straight in. And I thought, wow, that was okay. And then I did another piece on Little Big Planet after that, as a freelancer. And by that time, so the Channel 4 magazine and the whole setup dissolved. It just messed up. The magazine was closed because, believe it or not, nobody wanted to read that magazine. and so I lost my job there, and so I decided to freelance for a while. And then a job came up at Edge, deputy editor, and I thought, right, I'll go for it. And I heard Margaret on the show sort of talking about kind of hiring me and the other two people who started at the same time with me, Marsh and Rich. And yeah, I remember this email I got back from Margaret saying, it's sort of, I sent in the official application and I emailed her at the well and saying, just to let you know, I've applied for the job and, you know, I hope you know that I really, really want it. And she replied just with like, I hoped you would apply for it. And I thought, oh my God, like this was, you know, like no experience I've ever had before where like the stars, something that I wanted for years, it was sort of actually seeming to align. And then I ended up getting it as well. So yeah.
Wow. Awesome. Yeah, that is awesome. I got to ask, because it sounds like you were in this sort of relatively high-flying sort of London media sphere. And I think, you know, games media wages kind of notorious for how low they are, I guess, especially sort of print at that time. I was curious, as someone who had a kid at that time, was there any kind of like tough logistical decision to make about, well, I guess I do this knowing that I'll miss out on X or that sort of thing? I ask that, I guess, as someone who is now in their mid-30s, and maybe I reflect on my decisions I made in my early 20s a bit differently. So I was just, if you don't mind me asking, yeah. Alex, I was curious if that was something you had to think about at the time.
It's an incredibly good question. It was really hard. It was incredibly hard. Yeah, we were set up in London. You know, we had a son. I mean, the fact is that, so at the time, he would have been coming up to 2 years old at that point. Like, we found the early years of his, of when he was, when he was a young baby, London was great because everything's really close to you and you can walk to everything, and you know, the nursery is right there and this is there, and you know, it was easy enough. But once he gets to two, he needs more space, and we just didn't have any space in our small flat, and had no idea of how we'd get more space without moving out, way out of London, where the prices would still be high, and you know, how would we make that move, and how would we get into London and into work, and and then we got burgled, and it was sort of like, maybe we should not be in London anymore. And this opportunity to move to Bath came up, but of course my wife had a job at a publisher in the middle of London as well. So what would she do if she moved away? She didn't know anyone in Bath at all. What would she do? You know, it wasn't in our minds that she'd become some sort of housewife, and like, you know, the idea of sort of what a single income for us, you know, on kind of pub, you know, magazine sort of publishing wages was impossible anyway. It was really, really hard, and it's down to my wife just sort of saying, yes, we should, is what you want, we should do it. I mean, she was getting tired of her job but didn't know what else she could really do, and yeah, she said it's what you really want, we should do it. And I, you know, forever grateful for that. And it was that move was really hard. Margaret, I know Margaret said, and I didn't realize this at all, that I managed to sort of score a wage because I was coming in from London and just needed more money, like a bigger wage than she was on. And that was shocking to me because it was not a high wage. It was still a step down from what I was getting in London, not massively lower, but it was lower. And we also then we had some hard years of kind of, you know, not having, you know, very much money as a household to live on until my wife sort of found a feat. Yeah, so yeah, it was a hard and a big and very hard move, and like also learning a whole new sphere of stuff with, you know, and she was also pregnant with our second child at the time as well. So yeah, all of that with two young children, it was hard.
It's very, very brave that you did it, and I'm glad it sort of paid off for you, you know, long term, doing that, because yeah, a difficult decision for sure, and a very different decision to making that as a single guy with a sort of like bum fluff tash just moving to Bournemouth when I was 18. Very different sort of scenario. So yeah, okay. So I'm imagining then that it was a fairly seamless, you getting hired by Edge. Do you remember anything about the interview process?
Yeah, I don't. I don't, because I'm thinking, did I have an interview?
You walked straight
I think
in.
I nice. No, I did. I must have done. So that, I just remember there's a part. Yeah. So I'd met Tony before, actually. I remembered, actually, during the period when I was trying to figure out what's, you know, I knew I was at the Channel 4 job and thinking, oh, I can't do this very long, and like, should I go freelancing? And I think the magazine's going to fold. Edge had an online editor role came up, and I managed to get an interview for that, and came to Bath to have an interview with Tony. It was a chat in the Crystal Palace pub. and he asked me my opinion of what was that Super Mario game that was on DS that came out?
New Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah, it was, wasn't it? He asked me this question. So what did you think of that? And I thought, does this mean that I'm meant to like it or not like it? Oh. Still don't know quite what the right answer was. I think I was very fence-sitting, I think. Probably answered it badly. That job didn't just didn't come off. Like the eventually, like they didn't even the role didn't even happen, and like, it came to you understand years later what happened. But so they already knew. So he already knew me, or like he'd already come across me by that point, and I'd already written for it. So did I come to? I don't remember it.
This time armed with a really hot take on New Super Mario Brothers. Yeah.
I've thought about it now and I hate it. I mean, I like it. What do you think?
Yeah, yeah, like it's beautifully presented, but ultimately quite a simple distillation of the series. And Tony's like, you're hired, you know? Very, yeah. Okay, good stuff. Yeah. Okay, so do you remember much about the era Edge was in when you joined? I consider this quite a creative. I thought that just the noughties in general were great for Edge, but I was curious what you made of the mag coming into it and what you remember about that time.
I was so like as Margaret said on the show, it was a tumultuous time because shortly after Marsh, Rich and I all joined, she left. And so effectively the only person on the whole team that had been on there for, you know, any length of time was Tony. Because yeah, like so there was a sense that, you know, with Tony the magazine was ours. Like we could do with it what we wanted, or like which I don't know, yeah. So there was this sort of sense of sort of like, well, we've just got to go ahead and make it, keep making it then, and which was exciting. Kind of a little bit frightening. I really enjoyed the era of sort of Steve Curran and Dave McCarthy and that team. I liked its opinionatedness, even if, you know, I liked magazines that were opinionated, and I'm not sure I'm very good at making things that are also opinionated, but I enjoyed reading it massively, and but I also felt that there was a sort of that era was looking in on us. I was sort of like, what would Steve think if he was, you know, if he was reading the magazine and seeing what we were doing?
Right.
So there's this sense of sort of you're working on something which lots of people are looking to and thinking, oh, it's not like those days, or oh, I would, you know, we would have done better, you know, better than, you know, different to that. It was a bit nerve-wracking, really. But which is not to say that it wasn't, you know, hugely fun, and, you know, this sense that we could think what we could say what we wanted, and that was great. It was a lot of fun.
I remember being very envious of seeing. I remember like you, Rich, and Martin all turning up at similar time. And
yeah.
You all seemed like really like in step with each other, or you seemed to get on really really well. And
yeah, that was still, yeah, I was going to say, like, it was the fact that, like, it was Marsh and Rich, like, each of us had very specific sort of takes on games and interests and perspectives, and we would just argue a lot almost exclusively in a good, constructive, fun, interesting way. Well, not maybe not interesting for us, but, you know, like, we would just spend... Yeah. Like hours just sort of turning our chairs around and just chatting, and that was this sort of collaborative sort of just really fun, you know, this idea that you're making, like, all making something together under pressure, under huge pressure, filling those pages, and you know, like Rich would say something outrageous about something, and then Marsh or me would have to kind of say, but what the hell are you talking about? And then he would push back and he would say something else because he knew something about, like, you know, some other detail of that related to this thing. And then you go, oh, maybe he's right. And, you know, and then you wouldn't talk to each other for a couple of days, but it was super fun. But of course, also there was everybody else in around the office as well. Like, sort of, I used to sort of swing by, you know, you all the time, Matt, like, sort of just chatting about Nintendo stuff, and You know, and you freelanced a lot for us as well. So, you know, your insights and the fact that our freelancers were always very close to us physically, so we could talk to each other, and you understood where we were coming from this stuff. You know, it wasn't that sort of divided, sort of separated thing that you often get in editorial, where everybody's actually sort of in their own little bubbles. You know, I felt that we were all sort of thinking and going the same way as each other. It's great.
I often felt like the next door neighbor in a sitcom, because you were tucked away in a corner. I remember there was a row of filing cabinets, and I would come and sort of lean on the filing cabinets and talk over to Rich and Martin and you, who were sitting on the other side of them. So it was kind of like, and special guest star.
Here he is. Here he is. Neighbour Matt. Hi, yep. Hi.
What about as a sort of, in terms of like the games being made at the time, it's the early part of the Wii, PS3, 360 generation, which I think in retrospect is a really interesting generation where a lot of new things were happening. That was something that Margaret tapped into a bit when she came on the podcast. Yeah. How did you find that time to sort of cover, Alex?
It was, I think it felt that we could grasp, like, as a multi-format magazine. I don't know how you do that these days, because there are so many games. You know, what on earth do you pick on? And, you know, ultimately you're going with what the audience is playing, and that's not necessarily the most interesting thing. Whereas back then, release rosters were actually, you know, there were some months where we were struggling to find enough games to review. Like, I knew that on Endgamer, Matt, like, you were really struggling, you know, sort of, because, you know, you were just on one format. And we were, but it meant that we felt that, like, we had a full overview of everything that happened in games. I don't think that was actually true, because we weren't looking at sort of like the sort of the growth of, like, really studying and kind of being involved with the kind of growth of the more casual games and stuff that actually have ended up being really influential. But, you know, mainstream sort of trad game stuff, like, we felt like we had the full thing.
After that, you ran the Edge website for 3 years. What made you move into online? And was that exciting to you to kind of go into this emerging media space? I suppose you had some of this experience from before, right?
I did it because I was told to, and I hated it.
Classic.
I wanted to work in magazines, you know. I wanted to work on that closed sort of, like, single thing where you make one issue, and it's sort of like it's got a beginning, middle, and end, and when you finished it, you start a new one, you know. And that's what I loved. And then various future-based machinations meant that the next gen website, which had been run or owned and administered by the Future US, and, you know, next gen was this brand which Edge was basically printed as in the US, and so it had its own website, and the magazine made some of its own content, but a lot of it was taken direct from the UK Edge. The website had no real relationship to us, but it was meant to be our website, and it was run by the US team, who we didn't have any particular kind of dealings with on the magazine. So it made sense that at some point this website, which was doing fairly well as a sort of like a game biz kind of website, would come over to work for Edge. But the solution to actually staffing it was to take somebody off the magazine, me, to run it, and promptly the rest of its entire editorial team left. So it was just me, and then eventually, a staff writer was brought in as well. And I was just sort of told that I was doing it on one day, and the next week I had a meeting with the person who ran that website. On the next day, I discovered that meeting person was leaving along with the rest of the team. And the next day after that, I was running it. So, and that was that. And yeah, that was not what I wanted to do. It was the worst circumstances in which to do it. And I did it for a few years, and I was desperate to get back onto the magazine, because I was still sitting with everybody, and they're all having fun, you know. what, stressing out a lot, but, you know, they were still making the thing that I wanted to, and I was on this sort of website sort of doing rolling news and trying to put some of Edge's values into online space, which is quite, you know, quite, I don't know, it was challenging. I suppose it was actually quite interesting. We had a policy at that point also that we wouldn't actually reuse magazine stuff, because we wanted to make sure that there was always value in the magazine, which meant that it was all going to be original content. I managed to get Chris Donlan to who's a Eurogamer now, but and has been for many years, but he was one of the main freelancers for Edge for a long time, so it's sort of he had a regular column. I sort of just got as many writers as I could with a very small budget to kind of be Edge online, you know, sort of try to get sort of that sensibility into it. But of course, you're so much more sensitive to the fact that online, that of metrics and about how popular stuff really is. And I don't know, I'm not the best person at publicizing things in that, you know, and to sort of to go with the populist way and making choices that might have seen the site be more popular. I mean, it did have a following, but it was hard. And there was an existing community that came with it as well. And that community had sort of evolved from the Edge forum, which was huge at the time. Margaret talked about it. You know, it's where she was, and this community had been moved from place to place as kind of various future decisions were made. You know, to close the forum, and so they moved somewhere else. And a lot of them moved onto the website to exist in its comments, but also on a forum that didn't really work very well, and they got angry about that. And so there's a lot of community management stuff, which is not something I've ever done or feel that I'm very good at all. All alongside it, it was definitely interesting, but I desperately wanted to get back onto the magazine.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think as well, like all of the decisions made about forums back then were just incredibly short-sighted, because I think that in this age we're in now, I think websites have a mass following but not dedicated community followings necessarily. And, you know, as they've come to depend on sort of Google ad revenue and they don't have that core community to lean on maybe for support, then I think that's put media in the position it's in now, whereas cultivating that community might have kept them afloat when they got to the times when, you know, like, we have to, maybe it makes more sense to have support from readers as opposed to depending on ad revenue. And now I think it's kind of like shifting back towards the community side, and you do think of these missed opportunities over the years of you had this audience and you let it go kind of thing. So yeah, it definitely wasn't just them who did this, but yeah, I think over the years,
so many things like incalculable value that's sort of just thrown away, you know, that community thing. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I'm sorry to hear that happened against your wishes. You working on the website. I think everyone has something like that in their media career. I definitely did. So you moved back into running the magazine, I think, in 2012. So I assuming you missed print. What led to you moving back onto the mag?
Yeah, what did so yeah I think sort of Tony was editing the magazine through the time that I was away, either all the way through really, and he was then going to become like an editorial kind of manager for the wider games kind of publishing wing of Future. So Edge needed its own editor again. And so, yeah, they offered it to me and I took it on, and it's exactly what I wanted. I, you know, sort of finally I got back onto the magazine, and also as an editor, you know, that was a thing. It was really stressful. Really stressful. yeah, let's just put it this way, I lasted a year. I wanted to make it to a year, but filling, 2012, 2013, you know, there's a real sense that that magazine publishing was no longer the focus of PR, of audiences. You know, it was just, and so finding those covers, getting them on there, it was a real challenge. Learned a huge amount. You know, it, it, sort of, you know, working with an editorial team as well. But by this time, we'd sort of had a few new people. So we had Craig Owens, David Valjallo, Jason Killingsworth. So three new people that joined the team. Ben Maxwell. So he'd joined the website and then had moved on to the magazine as well. By that point, the team was actually quite a lot larger than it had ever been before because we had the website and the magazine. I think that we had some real talent. Like Craig Owens was fantastic, just really lovely to work with. And like Dave Vagello was just so sort of energy filled and just sort of...
And had lovely hair.
Wonderful hair, very good looking man. You know, he'd sort of like, could you take this on? Yes. And it would happen sort of thing. It was interesting, but it was like, I don't think we didn't have the same coherence as we had when I started. Everybody had very specific interests and there wasn't as much meeting of minds as we had earlier on. And it was tough to kind of get everybody pulling along in the same way. And not because of any individual kind of problems. It was just team stuff. And I completely, like, surely this is something that I'm responsible for. I was kind of thinking we should have morning meetings and, you know, sort of almost scrum stand-ups and things. Should we do that? And, you know, trying to sort of put some sort of, you know, rigor into it, which we'd never had before. And I don't think that really fitted. And I don't think I did it in any consistent way. Like, it was a lot going on. And I realized that sort of running magazines is hard. I've always thought the deputy editor is the best job on a magazine. Because you get to do the most, you know, you get first dibs on the interesting stuff because you're sort of, you know, fairly senior. But also because you get to be involved in everything without having to make the final call on everything. And it's not all on you, you know. You can only really make things better, you know. That's like ultimately, like, the deputy editor is to make things run smoothly and make things better, as opposed to make stuff happen at all. And I really realized that I like being a deputy editor a lot.
I'm definitely with you on that. I feel like, you know, when I was on ONM, I was associate editor, but because we had Chandra as editor in chief, you know, I was basically deputy editor with a, you know, slightly fancier title, and it felt like I didn't have to do anything nasty, but I just got to still feel like I was totally in control. I feel like it was my mag, even though it wasn't
exactly.
But with none of the stress. Do you also think, curious about that, you know, that earlier team, you know, obviously, like, the specific personalities of you, Marsh and Rich, you know, that factors into it. But, like, I also wonder if just being, like, earlier in a generation and you're kind of figuring out that generation together and you're discovering a lot of new stuff, and games makers are discovering a lot of new stuff as well. Like, I just wonder if that's like almost a better place to enter, if that makes sense.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. I think certainly, like, you're all looking at the same. Yeah.
Because 2012 is a bit of a weird year because you're like, you're into sort of like gossip and hearsay about what's going to come next. And you're like mopping up the very well established generation at that point. I do sometimes wonder if, like, you know, and I think about the times I was most energized and most excited, it kind of coincides with the start of things and being there at the start and figuring all that out. But yeah, it might just be coincidence.
That's interesting. I never really thought about it like that, but I haven't really thought about, like, what where was the industry in that year. And yeah, I don't think 2012 is a year that much. It's not one of the classic years. I don't even remember what came out in that year.
Yeah, I think it kind of like felt like that generation went on maybe a year too long. I don't remember that much about 2012 either. Far Cry 3 came out that year. That's all that came to mind for whatever reason. Yeah. But
But then, yeah, because it was because the PS4 was announced in the early 2013, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
So that was when, like, things sort of started moving again.
Yeah. I remember, because I came into PC Gamer shortly after you left Edge, Alex, and it definitely felt like that was another tier of the magazines feeling like they were not being pared down as such, but just, you know, I had one fewer staff member than Graham, my predecessor, had. I remember being given a number for the freelance budget to aim for that was way lower than anything my predecessors had spent. And it was just, it was that thing you said of like feeling the eyes of past editors looking down on you of like, what would they think of this? And, you know, sometimes I could read online what they thought of it because they would just tweet it out. But yeah, it was definitely, that was a really difficult time to run a magazine actually. And it definitely in retrospect, I really feel that. But yeah. Are there any particular issues of Edge you worked on that you're proud of or pieces on the site that you worked on?
Oh man. Oh God, that's hard. I can't remember. Yeah, you did write this one. I missed my eyes. I should have just looked at it.
Like this.
Nah. Yeah, no, not really.
Like I associate with certain things. Like I definitely associate you with a lot of Edges, like Little Big Planet or like Medium Molecule coverage. Yeah. I don't know if that's right or if I'm misremembering that.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
But like I feel like you got to tell that story, you know, quite completely over many years.
We did, yeah. And that's an example of that, like that sort of that creative that chemistry that we had back in the day, because Rich Stanton just like, that game is rubbish. That game is trash. Like, it's an awful platformer. And I'd be like, yeah, but you get to make stuff and you get to work around that stuff. And it's like, yeah, but the fundamentals, like the fundamentals of moving a character around feel like crap, he said.
Yeah.
He's completely right. And I was also completely right. And I think that meant, yeah, like that sort of disagreement, I really hope is sort of in the coverage somewhere, you know, sort of that it was asking the right questions, that it was critical in the right kind of way.
That makes sense. Yeah, I remember associating like definitely the first Little Big Planet with Edge, certainly. Like I remember that cover, and it just seemed like a huge event. And Matthew was often slammed Sackboy on this podcast. It's like that house in the late noughties, Matthew, must have just been you and Rich feeding each other's opinions about how bad Sackboy's jumping is.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, but it was interesting because, you know, I was friends with all three of you, and you know, it's exactly as you say, like you had such kind of clear tastes, and you know, I kind of knew the story behind some reviews, or I knew that if a game had landed in someone else's hands, it probably would have reviewed quite differently. But I always really kind of appreciated that. You know, I thought it was a period of Edge magazine where, you know, what, even if you disagreed with it or anything, it was always really, really well reasoned and well justified and very like accessible. And you say you liked that earlier opinionated period, but I really think that you know, that era, that sort of 2007 to 2012 period is my favorite period of Edge. Because I think it covers stuff I was really interested in.
Yeah.
I thought it made some big swings, but I didn't think it was like gatekeepery or obnoxious in any way. But it was accessible, but without being soft. You know, there was still a bit of acid in it. You know, both Rich and Marty are, you know, very like that. And it was just, you know, obviously I find it hard to untangle from my friends on the mag, but it really represented my taste, certainly.
So is there anything else that comes to mind, Alex, or is this, it's okay if that doesn't sort of spring to mind. It's sometimes hard to catalogue this stuff in your head and figure out what it is that you're proud of. Maybe you're,
I should have gone through my
proud
cupboard
of more recent.
Maybe you want to keep it a secret. Did you give any, many Edge 10s?
Did I give any? No. But we did have some good arguments about them. Yeah, right. There was a massive argument about Little Big Planet. That was huge. Because that did get a 10. Mm. But those arguments were exactly what was needed to make good opinion making and good, it was great.
Think Skyward Sword is a bad 10?
I think that everything, this just sounds like equivocation. I'm working my way up to equivocating here, but what I like, the writing justified it, and that's what is such an important part of those reviews. If someone has written a text that sort of, and the score says 10, but like the text just doesn't justify it in any way. Like, it's almost like there's an aspect of it that's actually outside of the game itself, you know. And your writing didn't represent the game itself at all. but the writing justified it, and I remember reading it and thinking, like, wow, like, this game, the promise of this game, sort of, you know, this...
wow.
No,
that's even worse.
The writing justified it, and therefore it would have to have been completely rewritten, and therefore wouldn't have actually ascribed to your experience.
Did anyone ever just submit something with a 10, like, completely randomly, and you'd be like, what the fuck?
Nobody ever did that, actually.
Right.
That's interesting. Like, I think that it was sort of so sacrosanct.
Yeah.
But of course, if anything was 10, like, you'd sort of, you know, you wouldn't give it to anybody that would have just sort of gone, yeah, 10, where? You'd only been core, like the inner circle, which it was very cabal-y. It was awful, really, a lot of us, but we were very cabal-y in that way.
I don't think that will surprise anyone who's read Edge over the years, though. That's seems very on brand.
I was going to say that there were a few things. There's one review that I was really proud of, actually, and really pleased with getting to do, mostly, which was Dishonored, and that was, you know, because it was Arcane that I came, you know, I sort of started things almost with Arcane stuff. It was an awesome game, and it was based on it was one of those review trip ones where we all had to play it in Bethesda's office in London, so we were all staying in a hotel nearby. Tom Francis was there, and a few other people, and I knew Tom before that point, but on this trip we sort of spent a lot of time with each other, and we're talking about the game, and it was, you know, on the surface of it, playing games in the publisher's office of, you know, 3 days or whatever it was is kind of bad, but it also meant that, like, all I was doing and thinking about was that game for that period. And I gained an understanding of that game that I probably would never have done if I was playing it at home or in the office or anything like that. I was going to continue distracted. And it was, you know, it was a great game and a really fun experience of doing it like that. And I enjoyed writing it because it was a game I was so excited about. And that was a 9, and an easy 9 of that.
That was 2012, Dishonored. And it's kind of a perfect Edge game in some ways as well, right? Because this sort of, like, classier type of blockbuster. Yeah. It's sort of very rare, and certainly there wasn't much else around like it at the time. Yeah. So, yeah. Yes, very cool. Okay. Do you have any cursed or funny press trip stories you can share with us, Alex? This is something we always ask guests who have worked in games media, because if you're around in the noughties, you probably went on some bullshit THQ trip or something like that. Anything you can share on your side?
See, I didn't go on that many, because I had this young family, so I didn't go on that many. So it would always be Rich and Marsh that went on the THQs and so on. There was, let's think, there are a couple that I did with Matt that were, there was one where I was trying to remember, I was trying to look back at where I'd been, but I had this insane one where I was in the States on a different trip. I think it might have been to ID, maybe, but that wouldn't have been West Coast. I think it must have been West Coast. Anyway, I was in the States. I flew back to the UK, stayed at the airport, and then flew out to Germany to see Metroid Prime 3, and and it was that classic Nintendo story where you go to the main offices of Nintendo and they're the most kind of grey corporate place.
Nintendo of Europe's offices were, like, profoundly bleak.
It was really very bleak. Was it in Frankfurt or something? So we saw this game, and kind of like in classic Nintendo fashion, there was almost no access at all. We were shown a few things, and it was a cover feature or something like that, and and with you there as well, and sort of like, because it was one of one of those times where Nintendo gamer actually got to see Nintendo, was actually supported by Nintendo in some way as well.
So sweet relief. I was probably losing my mind.
Yeah. There was a much better Nintendo trip. We went to Tokyo for Dragon Quest 9.
Yeah.
No, wasn't it? Yeah. On DS, wasn't it? And that was a good trip.
Yeah, that was the great one. That was that's where we interviewed Yuji Horii, yeah, and the composer guy whose name I can never remember, and the his sidekick.
Yeah, the controversial. I didn't realize how controversial he was.
Yes, yeah. but in that incredibly grim Square Enix generic, yeah, like the most generic office you could imagine, like, yeah, when you've just been playing the hyper colorful Dragon Quest to go to this place and it's, you know, as nondescript as it could be. Made Nintendo's Frankfurt headquarters look like the Mushroom Kingdom. and that was the... Do you remember the huge pile of cigarettes?
Yeah, I do. I remember it was like Yuji Horii was a strong smoker, wasn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, that always sticks with me. Yeah. That was quite a weird trip because the work element was maybe only a couple of hours, but yeah, we were there for like 5 days. It was quite a long one.
Yeah, we were sort of went out to all sorts of places. We went to the Pokemon store, didn't we?
Yeah. We went there. We went to some CD bars. I remember going there and getting like incensed about something. We went to a place with loads of like expats.
Oh, yes.
I found it really creepy, like all these like grimy like British losers, yeah, pouring at these young Japanese women. I just found it. I found it like really sordid. It really got under my skin. And
Roppongi, wasn't it? It was in that Roppongi district.
I can remember you sort of going, well, listen, you just gotta, you know, not try and get too kind of hit up about this. I remember you trying to calm me down because I was really cross. I thought some great social injustice was occurring before my eyes.
Yeah, it might well have been. I was just, yeah.
Wow, amazing. I feel like I'm building up a complete sort of account of this this press trip, Phoenix Wright style, Matthew, and more and more right, details sort of click into place, so that's good.
No, it's good. Okay. I had to say it without sounding weird, but like what I've always liked about working with you, or I have worked with you, Alex, is that I think people have an idea of Edge as you know, being quite kind of quite serious or quite serious-minded about games, but you're quite a goofy, fun person. Like, you're quite on these trips, and like, I always really enjoyed that. You were always an extremely good hang. I was always very glad when you were on press trips because, I think you're actually quite a silly end gamer person at heart. But
maybe deep within.
I think you're quietly authoritative in the way that sort of like I think like Mags people sometimes were, Alex. Like, you're not a splashy social media presence kind of person. You still have a blog. I like that you still have a blog.
That's my cool style. And a blog in the age of TikTok.
But I like that. I could, you know, it's sort of, it's just, if you want to find out what's going on with you, just go onto your website and read your blog. I like that as a function. Okay, cool. Okay, let's take a quick break and we'll come back and talk a bit more about your career, Alex.
Cool.
God, that was a dry outro, wasn't it? I promise it'll be more fun than I made it sound. I'll keep this bit in the podcast too.
We go straight into a fun bit of game music, so everyone thinks they're having a good time.
And then it's like, yeah, it's all new Super Mario Bros. Music. So, yeah, I'll balance things out. Okay, good stuff. Welcome back to the podcast. So, Alex has done a bunch of interesting things since leaving print, and really kind of maybe the most eclectic mix of stuff of anyone we've had on the podcast before. excited to get into that. So, I suppose, Alex, what made you leave Edge to begin with? Was it just the stress of print media, or were you just looking to do something else?
Yeah, it was the stress, and I just felt I think it was mostly me, because obviously Edge is actually sort of, you know, has totally persevered and under sort of Nathan Brown, Jen Simpkins and on the current team with kind of Chris and the, you know, it has kind of like new lives with new voices and things. But I had this sense that sort of the ship was sinking, and I think it really reflected my sort of, like, you know, that feeling where you get the thing that you wanted and it's not quite the thing you thought it was going to be, and you sort of, it's really stressful and it makes you sad and I'm kind of thinking like ulcers and oh god. I think that this feeling that the ship was sinking was kind of very psychoactive sense of that rather than what was really happening on the magazine. But like the subscriber numbers are going down. I was thinking, I just don't want to be the guy who just sinks Edge. Please don't make me be that person. So I thought, right, it's time to move on. And I thought, right, clean break. Let's go freelancing.
Yeah, okay. So it's interesting. So after that, again, basing this on LinkedIn, you end up working at Hello Games for a few years, and including the No Man's Sky reveal. I remember when we at the first PC gaming show at E3 2015, I think it was, we were revealing the PC version on stage, Alex. Yeah. So you're very plugged into that. Was there quite a deep pre-existing Hello Games Edge relationship? I seem to recall that being something that existed there.
Yeah, so I met them. When Hello Games started, they had the game Joe Danger, and you know, they'd all worked at that. Actually, this was something that bubbled up during the period that we were working on Edge, was the move for, you know, the growth of indie games, and this idea that the seasoned developers working for companies went broke off and started doing their own thing. And Hello Games were one of the big examples of that. So they, you know, they worked at Criterion, you know, worked on Burnout and Black and games like that. And these four developers came off and produced completely on their own with their own engine, Joe Danger. And I got this email one day from this guy called Sean Murray saying, you know, hey, we're these four guys, we've done that. And I just thought, that's one hell of a story. I just thought that feels like it's a real example of what's happening now. And so, you know, so just come to the office. And so they came to the office and gave a demo, and, you know, and this game was sort of bright and breezy at the time. You know, it looked fantastic. You know, most kind of truly indie games at the time sort of, you know, really reflected the fact they were made by a small number of people. But this one just looked like, you know, it was aspiring to be sort of bouncy like a Nintendo game. And, you know, that was fascinating. So I stayed in touch with them. We covered it and we stayed in touch with them, and Sean would pop up now and then, we just chat and things, and when I went freelance, he got in touch and said, oh, I'm looking for someone to sort of help out with sort of press stuff for around Joe Danger things. So Joe Danger 2 had just about come out, and there was sort of like a PC version coming and mobile versions and things like that. So I joined them sort of, you know, a few days a week working on that.
Yeah. So is there anything you can say about that time? Because you know, you were there as it went from Joe Danger to No Man's Sky. Yeah. So I imagine that transitioning from working in print, from print stress to game development stress. What can you say about working at Hello Games at that time?
It was totally fascinating. No Man's Sky was a real roller coaster, like a massive roller coaster. Like when I first started there, like it was just, you know, getting any interest at all in you know, a Joe Danger PC version and things. It was hard work, you know. I had the idea that, oh, maybe we can ask Valve whether they would let us put Team Fortress 2 characters into Joe Danger for the PC version, which they said yes, and so we did. What if we asked Mojang to put Steve from Minecraft into it, and they said yes, and so we managed to get some sort of interest in that. But it was like work to do that sort of thing. And that then transitioned to kind of the exact opposite, you know, into sort of 2014, 2015 with No Man's Sky, where it just sort of exploded. So seeing both ends of that, you know, the grifting and then the kind of like the op was just the sort of panic of a kind of a train kind of careering down the tracks was like, yeah, like nothing else. and super fun as well, you know, sort of went to Las Vegas and sort of E3s and things with it, you know, sort of.
Did you get to meet Geoff Keighley?
Yes, yeah, Jeffers, yeah, sort of.
You and Geoff tight?
Super tight. he's kind of exactly who you'd think he is. Like he's totally personable, absolutely. And because he's also organizing a show, he is like during a conversation, he is like also on his phone at the same time. Maybe this is
right.
It's like, so we had lunch with him and like it's sort of, he's just sort of like exactly in both spaces at the same time and kind of, yeah, it's sort of, yeah, he's wow. A guy.
He's a guy. Yeah, that's interesting. Did you have to decide how to demo No Man's Sky to press? Because that's sometimes a key part of what PR people end up doing, right? Is how do you, what slice of the game, you know, do you do? I'm guessing there was some kind of like vertical slice they made for a demo, that sort of thing, but what sort of hand did you have in that?
So not an awful lot actually, because I mean Sean Murray, like as you'll come across, is that guy has very sort of specific ideas what he wants to do and how he wants to do it, and you know his you know like No Man's Sky was very very much his baby. It's like and he had a full picture in his head of how he wanted it to play out and how he felt that would be best. So, you know, he would test ideas for me. Like it were just the sort of intense sort of day long conversations where he'd just sort of hammer me with what exactly he wanted to do and to kind of look at it from every angle to make sure that what he wanted to do was the right thing. During which sort of, and so the demos that we did that were sort of videoed and, you know, and kind of talked about and, you know, they were sort of, very much like his sort of, I mean, also of course the game was in development and so what could be shown was quite, you know, yeah, affected by what was available and also what had been kind of produced, you know, like a lot of stuff, you know, well, we knew that E3 was coming, you know, we had the game had to be kind of made so that it would support something that could be shown off like that. And so like, not being involved in the development side at all, and also sort of with Sean having specific ideas of what he wanted to do, like I was more of the sounding chamber. What will they think of this? How can we avoid them thinking that? That sort of thing.
Oh, that's, you know, very very important part of working in comms. So okay, interesting stuff. So after Hello Games, you worked for a company called Sensible Object on Beasts of Balance, which is like a different sort of challenge. There's a physical component to it and a video game component to it as well. What was that like?
Yeah, that was again, like a complete change. So after, you know, No Man's Sky, I left there before No Man's Sky came out. I just felt that I didn't really have that much influence in where things were going. Partly because, you know, the momentum that the game had built up was just sort of, you know, it was going to be very hard to kind of push it away from the track that it was on. It was a controversial place as well. And it was, you know, it was difficult. And I just sort of felt, well, I'm not going to be able to do much of any help there. So I sort of thought, right, it's time to go. In a very amicable way, I should say. Yeah, and this opportunity came up, like the head of this sort of new company called Alex, who I'd met again as usual, like years before Edge, sort of because he worked at I can't remember what the company was, but worked at various sort of London sort of indie studios and came up with this sort of physical digital game that he wanted to put on to Kickstarter. And the game was essentially this idea that you'd have these physical play pieces that you would sort of Jenga style kind of build into a tower on this kind of plinth thing, and the game would be able to detect kind of how these pieces were piled up onto it, and there would be a digital game that you'd play on a screen, an iPad screen or whatever, alongside it. Is really sort of interesting. Like it was sort of NFC style technology, sort of, you know, with the sort of chips in it that you the plinth could sense what was on top of it, which pieces. It had a kind of very very sensitive scales in it, so it knew kind of, you know, how many pieces were stacked on top of it, and like the whole experience was just incredibly interesting. Making a physical game with a digital game by a small UK company is an incredible challenge, because you're working with 3D printing kind of to prototype stuff, but then you're working with Chinese manufacturers to work on the PCBs for the physical stuff, the NFC stuff, you know, what plastics the piece is going to be molded out of, how it's going to come in on cost, all alongside trying to run a Kickstarter campaign with the price that would actually make sense, and not drive the company into kind of bankruptcy, because the price of plastics just increased, or, you know, the shipping costs kind of changed between the campaign and when it finally came out. So we working on that, and then getting interested in this stuff, because there's no existing, not really an existing genre that it fits into or fitted into. This is 2015, 16, you know, demoing it to people. It's one of those games where it's very hard to describe, but as soon as you see it, you're going to go, oh, okay, it's like Jenga. And you say, yeah, that's what I said, it's like Jenga. But yeah, but it's like Jenga, though. Like, you know, yes. And it was a fun game. Like, the game design is also, that was being developed on the same time. You know, it was, you know, making something that's very accessible, that can appeal to sort of young families. But also, I think the studio also wanted to, the main designers and sort of founder also wanted to make sure it had sort of board game aficionado depth to it as well. So creating something, I think it just about managed to sort of do all of this stuff, you know, balance all of these different factors into this one thing. And it was the first project from this new studio. And it was a real sense that also that kind of the studio was only just able to get enough investment to keep going, you know, and it was just sort of always on the brink, which is kind of exciting. And there's a real sense of sort of, you know, we have to work together to get this thing done and, you know, to solve these problems. And it's really exciting. You know, you work for, you know, established companies like sort of Future and things, and you definitely get a sense of doom a lot of the time, but you don't get the sense that you can actually sort of be a part of, you know, making it actually work out. And that was a really interesting experience with Sempstall Object. And so but then, you know, actually the money did start to run out, and the person that they rightly chose to end it with me was I was working on publicity stuff, and I left them at this point where they just couldn't really afford to keep me on, and that's totally fair enough. And eventually that team was taken on by, oh, I've forgotten the name now, the Pokemon Go
company. Niantic.
Yeah, Niantic bought them. And the game, though, was sold to a different company, and you can buy it today. It's called Beasts of Balance. It's good. It's good. It was really interesting.
Yeah, like the opposite kind of experience to No Man's Sky, I would imagine. So, lots to learn there. So you kept a foot in freelance for a long time. So still working for Edge, PC Gamer, etc. So what kind of opportunities did that afford you? Because I remember thinking of you as, oh wow, we're lucky there's still an old hand. Not to call you old, Alex, but you know, someone as experienced as you. you have a very youthful spirit, I would say. When I was on PC Gamer, running the website, we had very sporadic budget. There'd be some months we had none, then some months we had loads. And I remember commissioning a piece on flavor text from you, where you interviewed some of the localization team behind Dark Souls, which I don't think I'd seen much insight from those people around before. And I just thought you were very good at tracking down interviews and kind of creating interesting features for people. But did working freelance sort of unlock some opportunities you didn't necessarily have when you were working when you were running Edge or the website?
Yeah, definitely. I was I wrote several books over that period as well. So freelance is difficult, as you know. Like, it's sort of in terms of just making enough money, it's, you know, the amount of time you need to put into something, making it good is taking away time you could be putting into doing another piece that would sort of, you know, make more money and things. And so it's balancing that stuff was quite tough. It was really good to be working at Hello Games and then Sensible Object on the side. So I would do, you know, 2 or 3 days a week with either of those, and then the rest of the time was on freelance stuff. And that was a balance that actually enabled me to actually sort of, well, yeah, spend 10 years doing it, which was pretty incredible, really. But yeah, I wrote a few books. And what I didn't really realize was sort of, because I'd come the whole thing from a kind of a journalistic background. Something I didn't mention really about that working on Icon was that, yeah, it was a design and architecture magazine, but it was run by journalists. The sort of founding editor, this guy called Marcus Fares, he'd won journalism awards for business to business journalism awards for his time on Building magazine, which is about the building industry. So it's like, you know, a sort of super important kind of, you know, not known about sort of area of journalism, but, you know, fundamental. And, you know, stories that he did would break out into the mainstream kind of press now and then. And so as a journalist, he took that sensibility into the magazine that we made. And that's where I learned how to write about stuff as a journalist. And, you know, where you pick up the phone and you get in touch with people and you get quotes. And what I didn't realize really on a very deep level was that there weren't many people in game writing that actually were journalists, or, you know, they were game enthusiasts first. They wanted to say their opinions about games most. And so I guess I found it sort of relatively straightforward to write about games in a way that I found interesting, but also meant that I'd keep getting work, was that not many people sort of bothered to get interviews and things, which was a nice feeling, because it meant that I was consistently getting work and enough work over that period. And I got to do interesting projects. Like, I really enjoyed that Flavor piece actually, and many others that I worked on for you. But yeah, I wrote books as well. Worked on sort of Minecraft books, which we'll probably talk about a bit more very shortly. But like, I worked on, wrote a book called The Blockopedia, which is like a really, it's a hexagonal book. So that if you think about the kind of the Minecraft icon of the block from being seen from a sort of isometric angle. So you imagine the book is in the outline of that block shape, and that's sort of, it was that shape.
Incredibly shelf unfriendly.
Very shelf unfriendly. But it sold like so many copies, and it, like, nothing to do with me at all, because, you know, all I'd done is just descriptions of blocks. But like, I was, you know, and at that point, Minecraft was sort of massively blown up, and I was invited to these literary festivals, children's literature festivals, to talk about this book about blocks, because that would be getting the kids in through the doors, so they could actually sort of do the proper authors.
Oh wow! So have you had to talk to audience of children then?
Yeah, loads of times. Yeah, I did loads of these things. Yeah, you'd sort of get a sort of small, you get a fee for it, and you'd just do a talk in front of all these kids.
Do you get a good response? Because I wonder if a lot of these kids are imagining, you know, they deal with like YouTube, they watch a lot of like Minecraft YouTube also, I would think. Yeah. And you're not like a Minecraft YouTuber, would say.
I'm very pale down TDM, yeah. But still though, you know, like, for a kid, I was the avatar of Minecraft that day, you know. That was, you know,
right,
like, obviously I was not in any real sense remotely anything like that, and but for them I was this representative of this thing that they loved. So if they were like, there was a couple of times where I was signing books, and which was mad enough, like, I don't deserve to be doing this. And this queue would be just out of the door. And like, sort of, one of them was, took 2 hours to go through. And it was, and every kid was just sort of dumbstruck getting to talk to this sort of representative of Minecraft. You know, and it's sort of, it is a real kind of, you know, I'm just this guy who just wrote this kind of quite grumpily, I just don't want to think about these blocks anymore, you know, kind of in his, in, you know, in a room in in his house, and then you come out and sort of you get this real world impact of what you've worked on, you know. And these games were these books were treasured. They would often, some of them were, you know, the ones I was signing, they would bought on the day, but a lot of them they'd bought from home, and they were sort of dog-eared, you know. And that way, you were kids, you had these books and you just pore over them, awesome. Right, and that was being involved in that was probably one of the most sort of touching experiences, where you actually experience the sort of the effect of what you've made.
Have you ever been asked to sign an Edge magazine?
No, never. Not
well,
once.
There you go. here's a question. Like, are you a what kind of book signer are you? Are you just like a name, or are you like a little message kind of guy? Like, what's because I often think about if I got the chance to do that one day, what I would do.
I felt that you had to do a little message, but I quickly ran out of inspiration for what that message could be unless I was told what the kid wanted. I went with keep Minecraft in, but my writing
I was gonna say keep on blocking.
That's good. Oh shit, I could have varied it with
keep Minecraft. No, keep Minecrafting is good.
Yeah
keep on Minecraft in. Alex Wiltshire, the creator of Minecraft. That's what all of your signatures. I guess as well, when you're a kid, you just and you're interested in something, your parents are bored to shit of the things you talk about. If you find an adult who will actually engage with you about the thing that you're interested in, I think it is quite important to them. So I can see why meeting you would be significant to these people, Alex.
And just at the talks as well, like I just remembered that these kids would come down to the stage as close as they could when it wasn't seated. There are a few sort of auditorium ones, but like there were some where it was no seats. And the kids would just crowd down to the thing, and their parents would be sitting in these chairs at the back, all on their phones. And I was just sort of doing these talks, with sort of trying to do sort of talks about like little kind of mechanics-y stuff. And did you know you can do this? Little tips and tricks, and just I don't know, just varied stuff. And I'd be saying at this, and just looking at the parents, and you know, feeling the energy just sort of disappearing. And you look down at the kids and they're going and then the energy would come back up again. But just think, the parents had no idea of what their kids were doing, you know. They had no idea of like, you know. And I work for Minecraft now, obviously, so you know, this isn't slightly sort of suspect sort of you know, sort of opinionating, but I think Minecraft is a wonderful thing, you know. And it asks its players to do, you know, to push themselves into doing things that are remarkable. And I think the parents, you know, so rarely understood how remarkable their kids were and what their kids were learning through what they were doing. They were just appeasing their kids by taking them to this event, as far as they were concerned. And it was a shame. And I started sort of tweaking or trying to do what I could with the talks to speak to the parents, to try to sort of say, you should. Like, pay attention to what your kids are doing in games, because that, you know, like we're, you know, I think kids now play games as a matter of course, and we love that because we love games, and I really want all parents to sort of to play a part in their kids' kind of game playing lives.
I don't want to step on the toes of talking about the Mojang stuff, but where did this knowledge of Minecraft come from? Like, did you have to, like, you know, were you naturally playing it, or did you have to kind of quickly kind of swat up on it? Because, like, one of my big regrets over the last 10 years is all the Minecraft opportunities that have come up freelance-wise, I basically had to turn down because I know fuck all about Minecraft. Mm. So where does that come from for you?
Yeah, I just swat up. I did come across it in the really early days, you know, because, you know, just were on Edge and this weird thing popped up that people were excited about. So I was aware of it, obviously, and I did play it a bit, sort of thing, and you know, I bought a copy and all that stuff. But I didn't really play it that much. And then when the opportunity to write a book on it, you know, it's just the journalism thing came in, you know, you just swat up, learn about it, get on it. But then of course I think it is a game that is interesting enough to sustain sort of like a continual involvement with it, actually. Well, for me anyway.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and then I start playing it, and you know, every few months I'd sort of, you know, I'm always, there's a lot to that game, and it does sustain a sort of really long-term relationship. So yeah, it hasn't actually been a trial, even though it's not actually a game that I would. Yeah, it's not something I started with it as a journalist, as a writer first.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that makes sense. So I guess that is probably a good opportunity to talk about you working at Mojang, Alex. So what does your work look like these days? I guess how much can you say? Because every now and then Matthew will mention something that you're doing and it sounds very exciting. He'll just mention it offhand and I'm like, ooh, that's, that sounds like an intriguing career path he's got down
there. In a discreet way, Alex, I should add. I'm always very discreet.
No NDAs were shattered. But yeah, what can you say about where that's led you career-wise?
Yeah, I have a really weird job there because I'd started there managing its publishing program, because obviously Minecraft, there's a lot of merch gets made, and some of that merch is books, and it's important that the books are good and they're accurate and all that stuff, and because I'd written a couple of the books, they asked me to join them as a sort of a freelancer, as a vendor, as they're called, which I did for a while, and that's basically just managing the whole list, you know, sort of signing off on projects, working with their publisher, the publisher roster, sort of HarperCollins and Penguin Random House and people like that, sort of creatively directing the books and kind of guiding their development and essentially making sure that they're good and that Minecraft players are going to want to buy them and then like them when they've bought them. And that's like, it, honestly, that's been interesting. We've worked on comics with Dark Horse and all sorts of things. We have a manga, an official manga, which is sort of, you know, it's interesting as well. Hasn't made its way over here yet, and I'm still trying to make it happen. But then this opportunity came up, basically, because it's a Microsoft company, you can only be a vendor for a certain time before you can't renew your contract because of legal stuff. Don't really understand.
Right.
And so because there aren't many people that understand book publishing and Minecraft and all these other bits and pieces that I kind of quite uniquely have, they gave me a full-time job, but then added on some other stuff that I work on. So my title is Senior Narrative Editor, and it basically means that I work on any kind of storytelling stuff that is outside of the game itself. Which means that I work on, you know, the novels and comics that I've been working on for years, extension of that or expression of that, but also there's all of the other bits and pieces that are coming up that relating to Minecraft, some of which are public, some are not, that I'm also working on. And one of the things that I have been working on, not centrally actually, my boss is working on it centrally, but the Minecraft movie, which has been super fascinating to witness, develop, and kind of work on in a small way.
Wow. Yeah, to go from sort of like, working on sort of, I guess, Bookazini kind of stuff, yeah, on how this game works to that is pretty amazing. Admiration, I'm sure. You talk yourself down by saying you're the only person who could do it just by sort of chance. I think it's well earned to have stuck with it for many years and get there.
You can get, get me and Sam a little cameo in the Minecraft movie. I'll play a pig. I'll play anything. A creeper. I'll be in a creeper suit.
It's filming right now. It's filming.
Oh, well, that's
it's
that.
Too late.
That's that then.
Well, there's the CG to come in next.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So amazing stuff, really. To kind of go from Kim and Aggie to the Minecraft movie, but like truly all of life is in your career, Alex. Okay, good stuff. So the last thing I wanted to ask about was what have you been playing lately that you've enjoyed? Is anything you're ticking your boxes lately? You're a big Balatro guy, Alex.
Yeah, I have been Balatroing. I got a very good build yesterday morning. It's really good. I got to anti 13. That's pretty good.
Nice.
Yeah. It's preposterous. You can't buy it anymore, right? Because of the certification thing.
So that's,
you can buy it on Steam.
Yeah.
Oh, you can. I'll be trying to buy it on Switch.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not on Switch, but it's still on Steam. It's become like Flappy Bird somehow. It's just like, yeah, it's any Switch that's still got it on there is, worth a lot of money.
Yeah, it's like the PlayStation with a PT on it. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
That. But then that also inspired me to properly start with Cobalt Core, which I think I might like more. I'm not sure yet, but both of those games.
And Bellatro, right?
Maybe, I'm not sure, but they're both. I mean, like Bellatro is a lot of it's great. Baldur's Gate 3, which I'm finally getting around to it too.
Where do you sit on all the thirstiness around that game? Is that your bag, or are you kind of like a?
I don't.
Would you mod it out if you could?
I mean, I don't really like these shows of emotion and kind of closeness, right. So I when you've got, I mean, it's they're in so many games now. You get the dialogue, and you get the option saying maybe we should getting to know each other a little closer, and it's like, oh fuck, any option than that, no. And it's sort of, right. I mean, it's the worst thing. I just can't abide the thought of, I mean, my wife coming in and seeing me watching two game characters going at each other, and I start rehearsing the excuses. It's like it's nothing I could do. So I'm against thirst.
Good.
But it's like,
that's good. Okay.
But it's just like I went through this in Cyberpunk as well. Obviously, there's all the Cyberpunk thirst. You've got to tightrope walk around all that as well. Because that one's quite.
I don't want to miss content though. That's how I think about it. That's how I justify it to anyone who walks in.
Yeah.
It's like, I just want to see all the content. And if that content is spicy, then that's so on the game, not me.
Yeah, that excuse you've used for that, Matthew, for immortality, just like lots at this point.
I've got to click here to see all the content.
Well, that's probably that's presumably plenty of your adult life consumed by those two games, Alex. Is there anything else?
I just want to celebrate my now 5-year. When did Red Dead Redemption come out? Is it 5 years ago?
2018.
So we're coming up to 5 years. I've nearly finished it, and
oh nice.
And and I every time I've got this sort of save menu is basically just this record of all these years that I've played it for a few months and then sort of dropped it, and it's a game that apparently doesn't want to end because the epilogue just goes on and on, it seems. but that game, every time I thought, oh, it's like coming home, I don't really want it to end, but of course I do want it to end, I want closure, but at the same time anyway, it's a lovely game. It just keeps surprising me.
Great stuff. Yeah absolutely. It's one that I've basically I started my journey with it last year, chipped away the tiniest bit, and then just many other 100-hour games have come out since then. So it's pushed the back of the queue.
That's exactly what keeps happening to me. But give it 5 years and you might be coming towards the end.
Okay, good. By then there'll be GTA 6 as well. Just too many games. Okay, great stuff. Well, it's been great having you on, Alex. Thank you so much for talking us through your career. And yeah, it's been a lot of fun. And sorry you had to do it with the cold as well. I know that you, that's a great sacrifice you made on our behalf. So
not at all.
Do appreciate it. Where can people keep up with you on online?
Well, let's just go to the blog. Go to my boomer blog. <Yeah. laughs> which is rotational.co.uk. I don't really know why I have it, but then because I don't really use social media anymore, it feels like the right way of just sort of feeling as if I can be online if that is a thing that I need to be. I'm enjoying having a job where I don't need to be visible. You very astutely said that I'm not sort of someone that sort of, I'm a games kind of journalist or writer that isn't particularly online, and that it's been a struggle through the times when I was a freelancer sort of feeling like it should be, because work comes from doing that, but now I don't need it for work and I can just be a boomer and have a website and it's good.
Oh, bliss.
Sounds good, dream. To be honest. Okay, well, great stuff. People can find you there then, rotational.co.uk. And so, Matthew, where can people find you online?
Oh, nothing as classy as a blog. MrBasil_Pesto on Twitter, or Blue Sky, MrBasilPesto, no underscore.
I'm Samuel W. Roberts on both Twitter and Blue Sky. Podcast is BackpagePod, patreon.com/BackpagePod if you want to support us and get more podcasts. That's all the stuff. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back next week. Goodbye.
Goodbye.